Lecture 3. Politics and Tyranny in Greece.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. In our last lecture, we talked about the plight of the poor throughout Greece at the hands of ruling families. I mentioned how in Attica, for example, ordinary farmers found themselves not just losing their lands to their rich aristocratic neighbours, whom they turned to in times of trouble, but they could also find their families being sold into slavery as a means of these aristocratic neighbours recouping something of their losses. Now, this is a terrible situation, as I said, because we have citizens who are theoretically equal, and yet the reality shows that they're not. It reminds you of the line from George Orwell's Animal Farm, where Napoleon the pig says that all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. So much then for this concept of citizenship where everyone is equal. And needless to say, losing your lands, seeing your family sold into slavery, is going to cause an enormous amount of resentment throughout Attica. And it will give us a scenario for civil strife, unless these ruling nobles, these eupatridae, can do something to alleviate the problem. But there wasn't just strife in Attica. This seems to have been rampant throughout Greece. We find resentment against ruling families being felt not just by farmers in Attica who were facing starvation because their lands couldn't support the crops they needed, or that they were in debt to the aristocrats, as I said, but there was also resentment being voiced by a middle stratum of society. Now, these people, the middle stratum, as I call it, were living a reasonably comfortable lifestyle because they could afford the arms and armour to serve as hoplite soldiers. Now, hoplites are a new type of soldier that become an integral part of any state's army during the archaic period. The hoplites as a group would soon have a political voice to use. But if you'll permit me, I want to deal with the rise of the hoplite army in our next lecture because I think it fits better there. For now, trust me if you can. I know that's hard, but trust me if you can when I say that the hoplites were a new element in society that came into being during the archaic period, but yet they were denied any chance of political power because of the oligarchic power of the ruling families. So, economic distress and social and political discontent came together throughout Greece, not just Attica, but throughout Greece. And that leads to a number of tyrant rulers in various cities, especially in the Peloponnese. And these tyrant rulers overthrew the ruling families and seized power for themselves. Since we have information on a number of mainland tyrannies, and their characteristics have a bearing on events in Athens, including the development of democracy and law, and after all, those are the two things that we're really looking at in this course, then what I want to do in this lecture is deal with the major archaic age tyrannies, but not that of Athens. Athens would have a tyranny. It would last from 545 to 510 BC. It was called the Pisistratid tyranny, but it's a particularly important one in the period of the mid to late 6th century, as far as Athens goes, and therefore I want to devote two lectures to it, and they are lectures 9 and 10. So what I want to talk about now are a few tyrannies outside Athens. Now, this phenomenon of tyranny lasted from about 670 BC to the end of the 6th century. Well, of course, there were tyrants after this period, throughout history and down to the present day, in fact. But in terms of Greek history, the flood of tyrannies we get in the archaic period starts to abate around the end of the 6th century. And so the period I just mentioned now, for about 670, 680, down to the end of the 6th century, is often called the Age of the Tyrants. Now, when tyrannies occurred later, these are for the most part found in the West, especially Sicily. One tyrant who comes to mind is Dionysius of Syracuse, who ruled from 405 to 365. That's a long rule, 40 years. And as you can see, it takes him well into the 4th century. But right now, we're returning to the Archaic period because it has a bearing on the development of law and democracy in Athens, funnily enough. Now, in this period, the Archaic period, the word tyrant or tyrannos simply means an unconstitutional ruler. The word tyrannos is not Greek. People say it comes from Lydia in Asia Minor, the modern Turkey. And it was probably adopted by Greeks to define this new type of ruler. And what was this new type of ruler? What was a tyrant? It was someone who, with popular support, illegally seized power by toppling the existing regime. It was then an unconstitutional ruler. Now, although the tyrants supported the people, they were aristocrats themselves. They were well known in their cities already, either from public service, military deeds, Olympic victors even. And they used this reputation to win popular support. They took advantage of the people's discontent, the sort of discontent we've just been talking about in Attica, and it must have been the same elsewhere on the mainland. They took advantage of that to seize power for themselves. Now, as we shall see, despite the chaos that might accompany the overthrow of the ruling family, many of the tyrants were what we might call enlightened or benevolent dictators. Their cities enjoyed a period of peace and prosperity under their rule. They were good rulers. It's not until much later, that's because of Dionysius of Syracuse, whom I just mentioned. It's not until we get his reign and his clashes with Plato, the philosopher, that the word tyrant takes on the negative connotations that we think of today when we use the word despot. Now, we don't have time to cover all the tyrannies. Not that we know a lot about the small ones anyway. Often we just know the name of a tyrant. So what I want to focus on in our lecture today is what I would call the three most important tyrannies outside Athens. And these are all in the Peloponnese, and they are at Argos, Corinth, and Sicyon. Sicyon, by the way, is very close to Corinth. The earliest tyrant on the mainland was a chap called Phidon of Argos. He seems to have been one of the hereditary kings of Argos before he turned tyrant, which is very interesting, a king becoming an unconstitutional ruler. There's one for the books. We don't know how or why that happened. The chronology is not certain, but he probably seized power in about 668 BC. This may have followed on from his defeat of a Spartan army at the Battle of Hissiae. Hissiae is just past the Argive border in the territory of Argos, and this battle took place in 669. Now, Phidon was an expansionist king. He wanted to extend the influence of Argos in southern Greece, and he was not afraid of taking on other states in the Peloponnese as well. And that meant taking on Sparta, which by now had been the polis of Laconia, that's the area of the Peloponnese in which Sparta is located. Sparta had been the polis of Laconia for quite some time by now, so it was starting to be a power in the southern Peloponnese. It's no surprise that the Spartans viewed his ambitions with alarm, and matters came to a head at this battle, the Battle of Hissiae. The Spartans clearly attacked Phidon because Hissiae is in Argive territory, so they must have invaded Argos, and he was defending against an incursion. His success may be due to his use of the new hoplite soldiers. Now, this could well be the point where he threw off the shackles of his kingship. Perhaps his power was affected some way by the leading families at Argos. Maybe the hoplites wanted a move away from monarchy. Who knows? Whatever. He became tyrant so that he could rule absolutely. And in 668, he interfered at Olympia, home of the Olympic Games, where he seems to have taken over the presidency of the Games from the people of Elis, a territory which controlled Olympia at that time. Now, this was a big thing. It would have enhanced Argos' prestige enormously in the Greek world, not just in the Peloponnese, but in the Greek world. Remember what I said last time about the Olympic Games being pan-Hellenic things. They attracted people from all Greece. Now, Phidon apparently died in Corinth, perhaps at the time when the tyrant of Corinth, a chap called Cypselus, was seizing power. And we'll talk about Cypselus in a few minutes. If this is true, if Phidon did die in Corinth, then it shows us that he wanted to take over Corinth as well, and especially its trading network. Now, Phidon was reputed to have introduced the first coinage in Greece, apparently striking them on the island of Aegina. He also dedicated some short spits, called obeliskoi, or unstamped iron pieces, in the temple of Hera at Argos. Now, these obeliskoi were not coins as such, as we would know them, but they were in use before the invention of coinage, when barter was still a common way of doing business. The introduction of coinage, of course, was a major achievement, and it's fundamental, isn't it, in stimulating any economy. But it's not certain that Phidon himself actually did this. For one thing, the earliest precious coins come from Lydia, perhaps in the final third of the 7th century, and Aegina is supposed to be the first place to strike coins in Greece. Since Phidon was tyrant in Argos, most likely 668, he cannot have had anything to do with actual coinage, so this is a story that's attributed to him. However, he is said to have standardized the weights and measures for the entire Peloponnese, with the exception of Corinth. This attribution is more secure because even as late as the classical period, the system that he established was referred to as Phidonian, so from Phidon. Now, this new system helped to promote economic and commercial growth in that region, in the Archelid, that is, as well as in other markets. To this end, his economic policy would most directly benefit the hoplites, the middle stratum of society that was engaged in trade. And so I think that gives us an economic motive for his tyranny. It was a means of combating the wealth of the aristocrats. Under the existing regime, that's in the days before the tyranny, the middle stratum at Argos was getting nowhere. The rich were getting richer, and that situation would never change, particularly if the monarch of Argos is checked somehow by an aristocratic council. But under a tyrant, things will be different. Hence, I think we can probably connect Phidon's seizure of power with the needs of the hoplites and the lowest social stratum, the farmers and people like them, who were facing the same sort of hardships as elsewhere in Greece, as we talked about last time. And in return for supporting him, he gave them what they wanted: peace and prosperity. Well, not so much peace, but prosperity for sure. So that's Argos. And now I want to move to Sicyon, which is really close to Corinth, and to a man named Orthagoras, who became tyrant at Sicyon in about the middle of the 7th century. And on his death, his son Myron I took over. We know nothing about these tyrants except their names. Well, other than both of them helped to develop Sicyon economically, because under their regime, Sicyon produced what the art experts say arguably are the best bronze sculptures on the Greek mainland. And we also know that Myron won an Olympic victory, and that's big news. The reason for the lack of information about Sicyon is because it was dwarfed by Corinth, its nearby neighbour. Corinth was a huge trading city. It was enormous. It dominated the isthmus. But things would change in the early 6th century as the tyranny in Corinth came to an end, and in Sicyon, a man called Cleisthenes took over the reins of power. Now, Cleisthenes apparently didn't become tyrant smoothly. He's supposed to have murdered one brother and deposed another. So it looks like there was some sort of strife over who's going to be running Sicyon. Unlike his predecessors, Cleisthenes was not prepared to live quietly in the shadow of Corinth. Nor was he prepared to see Argos continuing to rise as a power in the Peloponnese. And it really was. It dominated the Peloponnese. Cleisthenes had it in for the Argives because, among other things, he banned the singing of the Homeric epics, that's the Iliad and the Odyssey, because they praised Argos. He also tried to expel the hero Adrastus, who was from Argos, but he had a sanctuary in Sicyon because in mythology he was also a king of Sicyon. Cleisthenes tried to expel the cult of Adrastus from Argos. And he changed the name of the four tribes at Sicyon, because into which the people were gathered together. He changed their names because they were the same as in Argos. How did he change these names? He changed his tribe to rulers of the people, archelaoi. But unflatteringly, he called the other three tribes into which the people of Argos were divided, he called them pigmen, assmen, and swinemen. That's not very nice. We don't know exactly why he elevated his own tribe over the others, but the other names give us some racial motive for the tyranny. It shows he was elevating his non-Dorian tribe over the Dorian ones. And you know what? These names stuck for over half a century before they were changed. Cleisthenes was also involved in the First Sacred War. This is a very shadowy business over the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. The First Sacred War took place in probably 595 to 586 BC. It was fought against the town of Crisa. And Crisa is situated on the plain beneath Mount Parnassus and Delphi. And Crisa controlled access to Delphi from the sea. And that's the route that those coming from the south and west would take if they wanted to consult the Oracle of Apollo. Now, Cleisthenes, along with troops from Athens and the state of Thessaly, attacked Crisa. In fact, he used his fleet to block supplies to Crisa, and this helped bring the war to an end. Crisa was raised, Delphi became independent, and the oracle was placed under the control of a collection of Greek states in what's called an Amphictyonic League. Now, an Amphictyonic League, the word Amphictyonic comes from a horrendous Greek word, Amphictyones, meaning those who dwell around. And it was thought that an oracular site, probably because of the First Sacred War being fought over it, that one place should not control an oracular site because it was so important, that an oracular site should be controlled by a combination of states. In other words, those who dwelt around it. Amphictyones, therefore, give us Amphictyonic League. Because Delphi is so important on the Greek mainland, we will see in history to come that states that don't dwell around it also become members of the Amphictyonic League, like Athens. But as a reward, Cleisthenes received a third of the spoils of the war. Now, Sicyon's role in the First Sacred War and its clashes with Argos brought it to the attention of states outside the Peloponnese. And an example of this, and perhaps the most famous event to call it that, from Cleisthenes' rule, that is, was the marriage of his daughter Agariste in about 570. In an effort to find the best husband for her, he organized a competition at Sicyon. Those who considered themselves worthy would spend a year at his court, undergo all sorts of tests, and the winner would win the hand of his daughter. If TV had existed in those days, we'd have the first reality show. Apparently, 13 suitors turned up from as far afield as Athens. And that gives us an indication of the influence that Sicyon was wielding now. This marriage was obviously seen as a good one. Well, eventually, only two suitors were left, both from Athens, a chap called Hippoclides and one called Megacles, who was a member of the powerful Alcmaeonid family, the Alcmaeonidae. It looked as though Hippoclides was going to win until he got drunk at a party one night and started dancing on a table. and then he flipped himself over and started dancing on his hands with his feet waving in the air. So he couldn't have been that drunk, because that takes balance. Now, by the way, sorry to disappoint you, those who are watching this course rather than listening to it, but I'm not going to do a Hippocleides in the studio. I have done this in class, by the way, in front of my students. Well, not the bit on my hands anyway. Anyway, Cleisthenes told Hippocleides he was dancing away his marriage, and he got the reply, Hippocleides doesn't care. And this became a proverb. Anybody who wanted ever to say something about I don't care anymore would say Hippocleides doesn't care. And so Cleisthenes gave Agoriste to Megacles. Now this is a funny story, but step back and think about it for a second or two. The Alcmaeonidae were one of the most powerful blue blood families in Athens. And you can see the influence Sicyon had if a member of that family were to marry the tyrant's daughter. Our final tyranny that I want to look at today is that of the Cypselids at Corinth. And that lasted for over 73 years. Now, before the tyranny, Corinth, like many other states, was ruled by a hereditary noble family. This one was called the Bacchiades or the Bacchiadae, and they were descended from a legendary king called Bacchus. This family controlled political life. So again, like elsewhere, we have this narrow ruling oligarchy, marrying within itself to preserve exclusivity. Now, Corinth prospered because of its location on the isthmus, and it was wealthy. In fact, if you read the Homeric poems, the epithet that is attached to Corinth is wealthy. It founded a large number of colonies with an eye to the trade routes to the west. And of note are Syracuse that was founded in 734 BC. Now, Syracuse would soon become the most powerful polis on Sicily. This is Syracuse, by the way, in Sicily, not New York State, as one of my students once wrote. Another powerful state that was founded by Corinth was Corcyra, the modern Corfu, also on the trade route to the west. The story goes that a member of the Bacchiadae, a woman called Labda, was lame. And because of this, no one in the clan wanted to marry her. Remember I said how members of the clan only married within each other to preserve their exclusivity and power. So Labda, because she was lame, was allowed to marry outside the clan. She did so. We don't need to worry about the circumstances of the marriage. And she gave birth to a son called Cypselus. And it was Cypselus whom the Bacchiades tried to kill because a Delphic oracle prophesied he would one day rule Corinth. In other words, this son of hers, Cypselus, would expel the Bacchiades and rule in their place. There's a nice little story, by the way, about how Cypselus got his name. Apparently, when the Bacchiades came looking for him, she, that's the mother, hid her baby son Cypselus in a chest. The Greek word for chest, Cypselus. I couldn't make this stuff up. Oracles tend to come true, and this one did, because in about 657 or so, Cypselus seized power and expelled the ruling Bacchiades. And he now set himself up as tyrant for 30 years. It's possible that his success was due to Corinth's decline in the Peloponnese because of the growth in the power of Argos, thanks to the tyrant Phaidon. And also in about 664, so a few years before Cypselus seized power, Corinth had suffered a naval defeat at the hands of its colony Corcyra. So the Corinthians, the people of Corinth, may have been discontented with the Bacchiades because of these setbacks, and so Cypselus was able to take advantage of the unrest. It's interesting, by the way, here, that reminds me, I will mention this here, a battle between Corinth, the mother city, and its colony Corcyra. This just shows us that relations between colony and mother city were not always that amicable. As I said in the last lecture, once the colony, the Apoikia, was founded, it became autonomous, and that meant, if necessary, it could go to war against its mother city, and many of them did, and this is an example of one. Anyway, let's get back to Cypselus. His rule was generally mild. He was a good guy. The impetus he gave to pottery manufacture benefited Corinth's economy, and Corinth became the leading producer of pottery in Greece for almost a century. Its best known item was the decorated perfume flask, about 2 to 3 inches high. It was filled with scented olive oil. It became really fashionable to have one of these, a bit like having a designer purse today. It also seems that the Corinthians introduced a new artistic design called black figure. Now, this was where a figure, that's a human or an animal or a tree or a weapon or whatever, was drawn in outline on the clay of the pot, and during the firing process, the picture, the figure, turned black. Finer details were then added to it by the painter using a sharp tool that was probably similar to that scary-looking hook that dentists use to get rid of plaque on teeth. Now, these additions gave the figure a three-dimensional aspect. We don't have a naturalistic portrayal of the human form because it appeared in black. But nevertheless, the style becomes very popular, and it was soon copied in many places, especially Athens. Cypselus also wanted his court to be a cultural one, and he attracted all manner of foreign poets to it. In this period, epic poetry began to be eclipsed by lyric poetry, which dealt with all manner of everyday themes, love, sex, war, sometimes seriously, sometimes crudely. Lyric poems were sang either to the tune of a lyre, the Greek word lyra, hence the term lyric, or a flute, and they were sang either by individuals or by choruses. Now, when Cypselus died in 628, the tyranny passed to his son Periander, who ruled for about 40 years until 588. You see, these are very long rules. Although he continued his father's economic and cultural policies, he was more cruel than dad. He killed and exiled nobles who had elected to remain in Corinth, for example. He also continued to expand Corinthian influence further in the Peloponnese by taking over Epidaurus, which was then ruled by his father-in-law, the tyrant Procles. So there's an example then of another tyranny. We know so little about it in this minor place, Epidaurus. And Periander also continued what had become a policy of the tyranny in founding colonies, and that included Naucratis in Egypt for trading purposes. Now, when Periander died in 588, his nephew succeeded him, and the name of his nephew, Psammeticus, is testimony to Corinthian relations with Egypt. Psammeticus. Psammeticus, though, he ruled for only 3 years, 588 to 585, and then the tyranny was overthrown. So let me give some general concluding remarks now on tyranny. It can be seen that the tyrannies and the tyrants shared a number of common characteristics. All the tyrants contributed to the economic well-being of their cities, especially in pottery manufacture. They introduced building programs like temples to beautify their cities. They arranged for an adequate water supply into the city and drainage to better the lifestyle of the people. They also worked to establish their cities as intellectual and cultural centers, encouraging foreign craftsmen and poets, for example, to come and live in them. Now, these sorts of characteristics are probably to be expected. You're probably thinking, so what? I mean, after all, to maintain their regimes, they needed to keep popular support. And bettering the lifestyles of the people, advancing their cities economically, beautifying them with buildings, well, there are means to this end. There might not be one single explanation for the phenomenon of tyranny. And probably individual circumstances in cities led to tyrants seizing power in them. Racial reasons in Sicyon. Military reasons in Argos, for example, especially if Phidon's power base was the hoplite army. But what tyranny does have in common is the overthrow of the existing regime. Now, since life under aristocratic rule was far from good in Attica as well, the question is not so much whether Athens was also destined for a tyranny, but when tyranny was going to happen. Well, it's actually not that far away, and we're going to start the lead up to it and talk about hoplites more in our next lecture. Thank you very much.